in honor of his passing the bar. That's number two for TBT from TBT Muncie. Shkayach Mehigola Chayel L'Chayel. One of the mitzvahs that are brought in the Torah is a specific mitzvah to blow the shofar on the beginning of the year of the Yovel. There are various mitzvahs that are difficult to keep, and part of the Yovel is a very, very difficult mitzvah. Because as we know, there's a 7-year cycle in Jewish calendar. Work the land for 6 years, the 7th year is the Shemitah. That cycle is repeated 7 times. After the 49th year, the 50th year is a repetition, another Shemitah year. But there are other additional factors that come into play during that Yovel year, including which is any Eved Ivri that was sold, whether it be for the short amount of time till the Shemitah, or even if he was sold himself into slavery for longer, goes free. And the Sefer HaChinuch explains that on Yom Kippur of the Yovel year, there is a mitzvah same in a Torah to blow the shofar. And he explains the reason why the shofar is blown on Yom Kippur is to let the world know this is the Yovel year, and all Avodim, all Eved Ivris will be freed. The whole world should know it, and it should be proclaimed. And then he explains why the Torah wants this to be publicly known, specifically that the Jewish slaves are being freed, and he explains as follows. He says there are certain mitzvahs that are difficult to fulfill. One of them is freeing your slave. Imagine that you're living in an agricultural society, and you own a loyal servant who's been working for you many, many years. He's very, very loyal, he's very dedicated, and from a financial perspective alone, his work is very valuable. You've come to rely on him, and now you're obligated to free him. That is a very difficult mitzvah to do. You may be tempted not to do it. You may feel it's too big an assignment. You may feel you're not up to doing it. So the Torah gives you this mechanism to give you chizik, to give you strength. What's that mechanism? The mechanism is they blow the shofar on Yom Kippur at the beginning of the Yovel year to tell you, Mr. Slave Owner, you're not alone. You're not the only person who's freeing his slave. The rest of the Klal Yisrael as well. Every single slave is going free. Everyone is doing it. And therefore, it will be much easier for you, and you'll be able to now do what you could not have done before. And that's how the Sefer HaChinuch explains this particular mitzvah. And the question that I'd like to ask on this Sefer HaChinuch, I think, is rather obvious. And that is that we're dealing with a sophisticated business owner, not a teenager. The person who has this slave is faced with a major nisayon. If you read about the farmers now, this year in Eretz Yisrael, keeping Shemitah is a very, very big deal. It means no income. If in fact you make your living by selling tomatoes, by selling flowers, by selling crops of the land, and you're out of business this year, standing strong and saying, I will do that, I will not work the land, is a major nisayon. The person that we're dealing with over here is a businessman. He's a mature individual who's faced with a major nisayon. He's not a teenager. What difference does it make to him? Everyone else is doing it. If this is an assign, if it's difficult, it's difficult. If it's not difficult, he wouldn't be given the mitzvah. The fact that everyone else is doing it doesn't sound like it should make it any easier. If it's an assign that he can't stand, the fact that other people are doing it as well shouldn't make it now possible for him to do it. And the question is, how does the fact that everyone else is doing this very same mitzvah make it so much easier that before he had this tkiyah shofar, he would not have been able to do it? Now that he does, he would. The question is, what does the Sefer HaChinuch mean by saying that this is the reason to give him the chizik because everyone else is doing it? That doesn't seem to affect the issue over here. And to come to a little bit better understanding of what the Sefer HaChinuch is teaching us, I'd like to focus on a very interesting concept. And that is that oftentimes people misjudge evil. When people look at real Rishayim, they look at them as demons, as ultimately wicked people, hence there's no relevance to us. For instance, when people talk about the Third Reich, there's a sort of demonization of all of the characters, there's a certain putting them into this group of absolute evil people, such that they have no semblance to the human race. In 1963, Chana Aderet wrote a book called Eichmann in Jerusalem. And when she wrote this book, she was in huge hot water. Because what she discussed in his book was very clearly describing Eichmann not as an abominable terror, not as an evil individual, but as a bureaucrat. Not as a man who killed Jews with his bare hands, but as a man who sit there signing this train to go to this station, and this train to this station. He sat there running a very efficient operation. But the reason why the world took offense at it was because they took this evil incarnate, Eichmann, and made him real. You could almost touch him, you could almost feel him, he could almost be your next door neighbor. And everyone who read the book became very uncomfortable, because when Eichmann was this absolute demon, you can deal with it. This demon turned almost like a human, came into this world and did what he did. But when you begin describing Eichmann in human terms, when he looks, feels, acts much like you or I, except a little different, it's a bit uncomfortable, because then you have to start dealing with the human. And there is a book that I recommend reading. It's a difficult read, but it's well worth reading. It's called The Face of the Third Reich. And it's basically a description of the personalities of all of the powers that were. And that includes Goebbels, includes Eichmann, includes all of the upper echelon. And it's a vivid description, but when you read, you see that they were regular people, like you and I. They had good habits, bad habits. Some things they did were dumb, some things they did were regular, some things were comical, but they were not these awesomely evil incarnates, they were regular people. And I think there's a tremendous reason why it's important to read that type of work. Because when you recognize that these are human beings, you come to a fundamental understanding. And that understanding is that the Nazis were human as you and I, the same tendencies as you and I have. I'll grant you that there was a little bit of a difference. A Mulek has a nature, has an inclination towards rishis, has an inclination towards spilling blood, especially Jewish blood, but largely the same personality, largely the same human as I am. And when you open your eyes and see that, you get a bit of an understanding into the human. And if you say to me, well, I don't know, that's a bit far-fetched. I can't see regular people, regular Americans engaging in evil. I'd like to share with you an experiment that's well known, but it bears speaking out. Stanley Milgram, who was a psychologist at Yale University, conducted the following experiment. This was in 1963, right after the Eichmann trial. And keep in mind that in Nuremberg, the whole claim of the Nazi party was one thing. I was obeying orders. I was not evil, I was not wicked, I did not wish to kill Jews, I was ordered from above, all I did was follow orders. And person after person who took the stand had the same defense. And what Stanley Milgram set out to prove was that that's ridiculous. That if an authoritative figure commands you to do something evil, the nature of the human is such that you will resist, you will not listen. And I want to share with you how he set out to prove that the average person will not violate his morality for the sake of listening to authority. He put an ad in the local Yale paper inviting undergraduate students to volunteer for the following experiment. They were being paid a large sum of money for 1 hour. They all, quite a number of students, volunteered, and he brought them into the laboratory. They were greeted by a scientist wearing a white coat. And they explained the conditions. This was a learning experiment where they're going to analyze the effect of punishment upon learning. They were told that one of the students was to act as the role of the teacher and the other was to act in the role of the student. What was unknown to the participants were that the learners, the students, were not volunteers. They were professional actors. And when Milgram had these various students brought in, he brought in the one teacher with the one student into the room and explained to them the experiment. Basically, the student was to sit in his chair, to his wrist was to be strapped an electrode, and there was a shock machine. The shock machine had various integers, beginning at 15 volts, then it would move up every increment to 15 up until 450 volts. And basically, what was supposed to happen was, the teacher was supposed to give an experiment to the student. He was supposed to give word pairs. Every correct word pair, the teacher would say, well done. Any mistake that the student would make, the teacher would give a shock to the student. However, the rub of this was that every mistake, the teacher was supposed to ratchet up a little bit. Before beginning the experiment, both the student and the teacher felt the actual shock. They put it at 45 degrees. They felt it. And the idea was to sit the student in the chair and the teacher to begin the word experiment. Now, you have to appreciate what was being asked of the teacher. At 45 volts, it's not a big deal. However, when it cranks up a bit, it gets a lot more difficult. At 75 volts, the student in the chair, again, who was an actor, would begin grunting, oh, ow, letting out loud grunts. At 120 volts, he began loudly complaining. At 150 volts, he was trained to scream, stop, stop, get me out of here. I don't want to continue this experiment anymore. This is ridiculous. At 285 volts, he was to let out a scream that was to be inhuman. The experiment would be allowed to continue to 300 volts, to 400 volts. At somewhere over 300, on the label of the meter, said the word severe shock, danger. At 450, it said, implied almost like death, and there were two levels beyond that. Now, everyone assumed, as Milgram did, that not a person would ever go beyond 300 volts. And in fact, he interviewed various psychiatrists, he interviewed students, and everyone agreed that the most that any individual would go up to is maybe 150. The first experiment, they had 36 students, and here's what happened. 25 out of the 36 students went all the way up to 450. And what that means is, when the actor in the chair started screaming, let me go, let me go, the experimenter in the white coat said, let's continue the experiment. And when it got to 275, and the fellow in the chair was screaming, it's killing me, my heart, I'm going to die. And many of the students at that point, the teacher said, let him go. The scientist said, we must continue the experiment. And they cranked it up to 300, they cranked it up to 450, three times. 25 out of the 30 students gave three what they thought were potentially lethal dosages of electricity to the student. Now, you may say, well, okay, those are undergrad students who were young, maybe easily influenced, whatever. Stanley Milgram repeated this experiment again and again with older people, with younger people, with blue-collar workers, with white-collar workers, with educated people, with uneducated people. He did it in Princeton, in Munich, in Rome, in South Africa, Australia, and this is what he found. 65% of the teachers went till the end. Almost not a one ducked out of the experiment under 300 volts. And what that means in Milgram's understanding is that the average person, if put into the proper circumstance with a figure of authority who says, I'm taking responsibility and I say you must continue, the average person will. Even though many of the students said, but what if he dies? It's not your responsibility. We have to continue the experiment. And the vast majority of people continued. And it almost sounds like it doesn't fit the people that you and I know. I would never react that way. You would never react that way. Right. But the problem is, it was done in so many different scenarios, in so many different ways, and became such a famous experiment that everyone tried to slug up to prove that it can't be. But every time, it seemed to have proven the same point. And I don't think it only proves that the human is subject to authority, because I don't think that's really what it proves. I think it proves something much more fundamental. That is, that we human beings are greatly influenced. I want you to understand, if you were a young boy growing up in Nazi Germany, and you grew up in the Nazi youth, and from the time that you were 12 years old, you were indoctrinated into the fact that Jews are vermin, Jews are flies, like you kill a mosquito, you kill a Jew. It was a very difficult thing to resist that pull. Any human being has the capacity to resist it. Any human being is held accountable for giving into it. But at the end of the day, that's a difficult nisayon. Don't be so simplistic as to say every Nazi was evil incarnate. They were rishayim, they were wicked. They were wicked. They were very wicked. But at the end of the day, there was a huge social atmosphere, a huge powerful social acceptance to authority, bowing to authority, and the rule, the law of the land was to go forth with this. Is a person responsible to stand up to that? 100%. Is a person held accountable? 100%. But at the end of the day, do not minimize the test. Do not wish for yourself to be in such a test, because it's not so simple. And I think what this is indicative of is something that we do not take into account, that we discount tremendously. And that is the effect of society on the human. The effect of others, the effect of social situations. If it's done in the world, if it's done out there, it affects us, it becomes part of us, becomes part of the way we think. And I think that's exactly what the Sefer HaChinuch is saying. This businessman had a very valuable slave, and it was very difficult for him to part with it. But you know what made it easier? Everyone is doing it. This is the way of the land. It's the Yovel in here, in the next town, in the next town, throughout the land of Eretz Yisrael. Everyone is doing this. Once it becomes something that everyone does, it's much easier to do because it's socially acceptable, it's done, and now this person has much less of an assignment. And if it sounds like that doesn't really add up, doesn't make sense, that's exactly what the Sefer HaChinuch is saying, that we are very, very much influenced. Rabbi Saul Salanta used to say it often. He would say, the nature of the human is to ape. We ape other people. If people walk one way, we walk that way. If they wear a certain type of clothing, we wear that type of clothing. If they speak in a particular kind of way, we speak in that particular kind of way. My little girls now are wearing silver and gold slippers. You know, like Wizard of Oz, Dorothy, slippers. They wouldn't have been caught dead 2 years ago and anything looked like that, but now it's the rage. But my friends, it's not just clothing. It's not just the way we talk. And not just the way we look at things. In the Chinese culture, if a son is killed, the father has the right to sue the killer. And you know why? Because it's understood that the son will take the father and mother into his house and support them in his old age. That means the parents know that the son will take care of them. And if you look around America, you see, unfortunately, a very, very difficult situation. One of the hard nisyonos that we face, unfortunately, is when a parent gets older. And sometimes you're faced with a challenge of what to do. But I dare say, the way we treat our parents, unfortunately, we're put to shame by certain other cultures. Because in certain other cultures, there's a reverence, a respect, an awe. And I dare say, the holy nation, the Am HaKadosh, on some level, does not quite live up to that which other cultures do. And it's not that we're lacking, it's that we adopt the ways of the land, we pick up the culture of the land, and what they do, we do, and it affects us. However, that's really but a very small point here. We live in very, very trying, difficult times. I don't think we've ever, in our entire exile, had it this good. We have freedom, we have opportunity, we have unprecedented wealth. And on the other hand, I remember as a little boy, the Reader's Digest was the one light reading that you could feel safe going through. 30 articles a month, you'd open it and you'd feel comfortable. It wasn't the deepest read in the world, but it was a good representation of middle America. This was safe, this was sober, this was good readership. However, I recently opened the Reader's Digest and I realized that I would never allow it into my home. Do you know, when my little children go to the library, the older girls play security guard. Every book, before it's read by the little people, is inspected by my older girls, because who knows what is in there. But my little people are 7 years of age, 11 years old, and I can't allow them to read a book in the juvenile section because who knows what type of concepts are in there. And we're not talking about teenage years. We're not talking about adolescence. We're talking about little people. And you quickly recognize that the world out there has gone deep off the end. We are not dealing with a sober, normal society. We're not dealing with an issue of, well, basically it's a wholesome world as it was in the 50s, and we have different ideals. We're dealing with a world that's teeming at the edge of every type of deviance, every type of decadence. You cannot open a newspaper. You cannot ever turn on a TV, a movie, go on the internet without being assaulted by such barbarism, filth, decay. I do not have words to describe it. And the question is, where does it leave us? So on the one hand, we're safe. Because Baruch Hashem, we have created our own culture. We have our own magazines. We have our own stars. We have our own music. We have our own movies now. We have everything that we could need to create our own insular, isolated world. And we're well protected in our cocoon, protected from the outside influences. However, I don't think that that's quite the reality. It's true on some level. It's important on some level, but the reality is very different. And I want to share with you something that I once got involved in. Someone once asked me the following question. He was not quite a Baal Tshuva yet, and he asked me the following. He said, why can't a yeshiva guy go to a regular college campus? What's wrong? University of Pennsylvania, Columbia, Yale. Why can't he live on campus? He has his ideals. He has his morality. Why can't he remain a good, solid yeshiva student and be a college student at the same time? What's the contradiction? Now, to answer that question, of course, I, as you would, the first thing that came to my mind was Benos Moav. As you know, the Bnei Yisrael were tempted by the Benos Moav, but it was not for znus, it was not for promiscuity. The Benos Moav tempted the Jewish men, and when the Jewish men were very, very much interested, at that point the Benos Moav would pull out their Avodah Zorah, and they said, you want me, you have to bow down to this. And that's the first thing that comes to mind, the amount of promiscuity, the amount of taiva, the amount of free whatever on college campuses. And again, you don't need me to fill you in as to how far gone it is. That's the danger. Now, my friends, I'll grant you that that is a danger. But I do not believe that that is the only danger. And I'm not even sure that that's the major danger. I'd like to share with you, there's a little pamphlet called Orthodox Assimilation on University Campuses. And this was written by two graduate students. And they have a number of quotes. The quotes are from yeshiva-educated students who were exposed living on campus. But what's amazing is that it wasn't that they gave up the morality, they gave up every vestige of their religion. And it wasn't just znus, it wasn't just promiscuity, it was every vestige of their religious beliefs. And I'd like to share with you one quote, not from a Jewish individual, it's actually the former president of Dartmouth College, James O. Friedman, who said as follows, the purpose of a college education is to question your father's values. You see, one of the major thrusts of a broad college education is to question everything. Question everything means nothing is sacrosanct, nothing is accepted as it is, everything is questioned, and what happens is a very interesting thing. I don't care how strong you are, I don't care how well worked out you are. The reality is you're affected by others' beliefs. You're affected by the popular notion. And if a yeshiva bachur with very solid beliefs ends up on a college campus, he is in grave danger. I'm not as afraid that he's going to marry the shiksa as much as I am afraid that he's going to adopt the ways of thinking, the ways of thought, because there is a huge, huge influence. And my friends, I'd like to share with you what this means in plain language. Most of us do not have that nisayon. Neither ourselves nor our children are holding by that. But I'd like to share with you something that I consider very fundamental. You've heard me say before that the nisayon of our generation is taiva. And I believe that that's correct. However, it's only rove. Only most individuals are affected by that. And only most people fall prey to that. I believe it's rubam b'taiva v'kulan, all of them, in a different sin. It's called the sin of materialism. You see, if you're 45 years old, and you're not affected by the world, you have the best filters in the world on your internet, you hire only men to work in your office, because you don't want to have any nisyonos. And you're really, really careful, and you really have protected yourself from the outside influence of the world, but you drive to work in the Jag, and you're doing real well, so you buy the $10,000 mahogany desk, and you do, after all, deserve something, so you buy yourself the $30,000 mechanical watch because it works better. You are now drawn into the love of the land. Now, my friends, I want you to hear what I'm saying. It doesn't seem so dangerous. It's not taiva. I'm not over any grave of eras. What I'm doing is I'm absorbing the culture. I'm using their value system to become my value system. And what I'm doing is I'm adopting the ways of the land, and I'm greatly influenced. If you don't think that every one of us is affected dramatically by the outside world, ask yourself one question. What is your currency? What do you value? What do you consider important? What do you really, really wish for? What do you yearn for? What do you set your goals for? If you really set your goals for growth, for accomplishment, for being a different human being, for growing and being what you can be, I'll grant you you're not affected by this land. But if in fact you enjoy the luxuries of this world, as we all do, and making it means, you know, making it, then I believe that you are greatly influenced, as all of us are. And I believe what the Sefer HaChinuch is saying to us is none of us are shielded from it. None of us are protected. If you put up very high barriers, and you have to put up high barriers, if you protect yourself from every incidence of taiva and desire, that's a great thing. But that's not enough. You have to insulate yourself from the culture, from the pervasiveness of the times, and all that it speaks. And what that means in plain language, my friends, is that we as Jews are obligated to think like a Jew. What we value, what we consider important, the way we look at our friends, the way we look at our parents, the way we look at issues, is according to the Torah. And the more we live in this world, the more we're influenced by this world, the more it affects us, the more it changes us, the less we value the Torah values, the more we value what they value, and you can't help it. Because we are affected, we're pulled in, we're schlepped in. And with that, I'd like to explain to you a mitzvah aseh min haTorah. There is a full mitzvah aseh min haRaisa to be dovek to Talmidei Chachamim. Being dovek, clinging to Talmidei Chachamim, means having friends who are Talmidei Chachamim. It doesn't mean aseh lecha rav. It doesn't mean find a Rebbe. It doesn't mean find a Rav. It doesn't mean get a yeshiva who you'll ask questions to. Be dovik to Talmidei Chachamim means find people who you can be friends with, who you can do business with, who you can associate with on a daily level, who are Talmidei Chachamim. And you may ask, why? And the answer to that is something the yeshiva told us many times. And that is the gadol is the one who's least affected by the times. The gadol is the one who lives in the Torah, whose values come from the Torah, whose worldview comes from the Torah, who lives the Torah life. If that person is a living Sefer Torah, the more he's in it, the more he represents it, the closer to such a person you can become, the more of a Torah lifestyle you can lead, because you see it, you sense it, you feel it, and you get to see it in your world. Finding Talmidei Chachamim is not that difficult in our time, but being close to them, making sure that they're your friends, making sure that you do business with them, you associate with them, you're involved with them, that you spend time so that you get to know them. I have a very unique situation. I can't explain too much, but there's a certain great Talmud Chacham in Muncie who I'm zocha to be mishamish, and my wife is blown away. I'll spend hours, 4 hours, with this man, and not because I'm asking him shilas, not because we're discussing deep things, but because I want to be in his presence so I can adopt more of a Torah way style. And understanding that we all are greatly influenced by the people we associate with, our community, our society, means there's a huge obligation upon me to create that society. And what that means is finding the right neighborhood, finding the right shul, finding the right chevra. Because if you think that you are an island, if you think you're an oasis, I create my lifestyle, I create my ideals, you're living in a world of illusion. Sefer HaChinuch is telling us a businessman faced with a very difficult nisayon, having to give up a very valuable piece of property. The difference between yes and no is based on one thing. If everyone's doing it, I can do it as well. But if he didn't hear that shofar blowing, if he didn't hear the call that everyone is doing it, he might well have lost that nisayon. He might well not have been able to do it. But hearing that it's popular, that everyone's doing it, affects him, changes him. And my friends, is a tremendous lesson to learn when you study Nazism. Because it was a unique phenomenon in the sense that it was a malek. It was unique in the sense that Hashem guided every step of the way, but human nature hasn't changed. And when Stanley Milgram proved, was a very interesting episode, authority and the human listens, and the human bends. But it's not just authority, it's all of the various social structures, and all of the various things that we're pulled with, and if you think you're any different, you're the same, we're all the same, and knowing that means understanding how much I'm influenced, how much I'm affected by the world around me, how much I'm affected by what I read, and because of that, it's very important that we create our own culture, we create our own world, but even then, we have to understand the effect, and you have to make sure that you choose your friends wisely, especially if you're zocha to be dovig, to cling to Tamei Chachamim. I'd like to close with what I consider one of the great chedushim in this sugya. The Medrash tells us, Oy l'rosha v'oy l'sheino, tov l'sheino, tov l'tzadik v'tov l'sheino. Woe to the wicked man and woe to his neighbor, says the Gemara. You know what that refers to? That refers to the Adas Korach. The 250 men who went to their death. And what does it mean? Tov letzadik, good for the tzadik and good to his neighbors. That refers to Yisachar and Zevulun. And the Medrash explains to us, do you know why it is that the 250 people went to their death? It is because they lived in the proximity, in the neighborhood of Korach. They were pulled into this machlokas not because of idealism, not because of philosophies, not because of belief. They were pulled in because he was their immediate neighbor. And because he was there, he created the social structure, he had stature, social influence, he affected them, and they ended up being swallowed alive to their death. And that's a chiddush. But there's a bigger chiddush, and the Medrash tells us, why is it that Yisachar and Zevulun got that great level? Yisachar being the ones of learning Torah, Zevulun being the ones to support Torah, says the Medrash, don't you know? Because their neighbors were Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen. Because that was their neighborhood, they were influenced, they were affected, and they became for eternity Yisachar and Zevulun. And now, my friends, here's the observation. They were all living in the Midbar. The Midbar was the virtual Beis Medrash. The culture was one. They ate the man, they drank water from the rock, from the Be'er that would travel with them. They lived with overt, obvious miracles. All they did all day long was learn. There was nothing in the social structure that mattered other than growth. But the Medrash is telling us a huge yisod. And that yisod is that we are greatly influenced by our chaverim. You could be in a yeshiva, but in the wrong chevra, and you're going to end up south. You could be in a great Beis Medrash. You could be a member of a shul, and the head of the shul, the rabban, the rav of the shul, everyone there are great people. But if you get into the wrong group in that shul, you're going to end up south. And my friends, it's a very interesting thing. We all think we're gansa philosophers, we're powerful individuals, we're strong in our commitments and our beliefs. Go to a college campus, spend any amount of time. If that becomes your social reality, you're in deep jeopardy. And if you find yourself in a situation where you have chaverim, friends that are not headed in the right way, you are in grave jeopardy, in grave danger. I think it's a tremendous lesson for us to learn, for us to understand. May Hashem grant us wisdom, understanding, and ability to put into practice.